We're told sometimes to think of race and blackness as an issue.
I pick up my life and take it with me, and I put it down in Chicago, Detroit, Buffalo, Scranton, Harlem, any place that is north and east and not Dixie.
But blackness was not an issue or a talking point for jazz legend John Coltrane or poet Langston Hughes. Race and blackness, through the voices and works of black artists, was much bigger. It was the counter-identity, staring down a white culture attempting to define blackness through slavery, through segregation, exclusion, or murder. Daring to sing about murder.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit.
Billie Holiday there singing about the strange fruit from a lynching. Poetry, violence, music, and humor. Some of the shades of blackness.
My kids, boy, when they lie, though, that's the thing that I love the most. When they be trying to tell them lies and you know they're lying. Right, you say, who broke this? Huh? I say, who broke this? Okay. And I was in here then when that thing was already broke. Uh-huh, that was broke even before I was born.
Comedian Richard Pryor joked about kids and racism, drugs, and the violence of the inner city of 20th century America. All of this is the backdrop and subject of poet Kevin Young's new award-winning book, The Gray Album. Part essay, part poetry, it takes its title from Danger Mouse's The Gray Album, a mashup of The Beatles' The White Album and Jay-Z's The Black Album. Young visited our studio this week and explained that he wanted The Gray Album to be a nonlinear exploration of the power and what he called trickery of African-American voices, trying to make themselves heard in a culture that often didn't want to hear them.
The book is about sort of what I call the blackness of blackness. I realized at first I was trying to describe the blackness of Americanness, or in many ways, how those things were synonymous. And I start in the book with slavery and the spirituals, which are coded means of expression. On one hand, they're talking really, I think, radically a kind of liberation theology, using biblical language and also vernacular language, which I love that combination, to talk about freedom and talk about escape, and then also to literally plan for it. And so I really
Also to conceal it.
Yeah, yeah.
To lie about it. I mean, it's
yes, so complex. It is. It's one of those things that I talk a lot about, this idea of elsewhere, and that in the spirituals they're conjuring this elsewhere, this place that's better, and how you see that in a different kind of elsewhere in hip-hop, whether it's Wu-Tang Clan turning Staten Island to Shaolin, or, you know, that kind of transformation of space is really a wonderful, I think, shared, coded, powerful thing.
And though we might think that there's quite a serious remove from the hip-hop of today and the Negro spirituals of quite a long time ago, this warping of reality, this whisking away of the city of New York or what's right in front of us is really a survival technique for slaves.
Yes. I think it's also a technique of triumph. You know, it's an artistic effort in the end. You know, it's one I call storying, just based on my Louisiana family, where, you know, you couldn't say to someone older than you, certainly, you know, you lie, you would say you story. And I tried to take that idea of the lie, which is another name for an African-American folktale, and turn that into a kind of thinking about the way that a Louis Armstrong solo tells a story, and these different kinds of wordless at times stories, but that there's a kind of continuity between them all.
You know, you quote Gwendolyn Brooks in here in a quote that's just mind-blowing to me. And again, it talks about this uneasy relationship between dreams and the grim reality for a large component of African-American history. We are things of dry hours and the involuntary plan, grayed in and gray. Dream makes a giddy sound, not strong, like rent, feeding a wife, satisfying a man. I mean, there's just so much there. There's this tension between the reality of life and the dream state, which is the pathway to triumph.
Well, and there's also the American dream, I think, circulating through this. And I talk a little bit about folklore as a kind of dream state as well. And that kind of folkloric resistance is also engaged in this idea of the dream, and also an idea of nativeness. You know, there's so many books, Native Son, Notes of a Native Son, Native Guard by my colleague and friend Natasha Trethewey, which talk about this idea of nativeness and of being, you know, one with America. And I think that's very important to these writers' vision of themselves.
And yet Langston Hughes, who you talk about in a brilliant set of essays in the middle of this book and really evoke beautifully, is seen among mainstream America as an other, whereas when he was doing what he was doing, it was an American voice to him. This voice is old preacher man, preach that boy away, charged $5, his girlfriend had to pay.
Uh-huh.
That's an American voice. That's not some fringy kind of Huck Finn sort of thing to him at all.
Well, I mean, you know, some would say Huck Finn learned what he learned from a black voice.
There you go.
But I also think that for Hughes, you know, that's from a book, Montage of a Dream Deferred, with the famous poem, you know, does it dry up like a raisin in the sun or does it explode? And I think that that quality is so crucial to him. You know, he's using in that poem bebop and montage and all sorts of things at his right hand, you know, while his left hand is playing this really interesting sort of under melody of the blues and of, you know, lots of other things, I think.
There's a real reverence for the ability that Langston Hughes had to put it all together, to sort of channel mm-hmm. all these phenomena at once. In some ways, it feels like you aspire to that as well, or have a yearning for someone to embody that in pop culture today. And there are some examples, but really no one as powerful as Langston right now.
I think he happens to be one of the great writers, so it's hard for me to say, you know, there aren't Shakespeare's exactly now, but I also think there are really interesting writers, and I do talk about sort of younger generation of writers who are doing new things. For me, I also was trying to talk about the music and how the music is a form of literature and how, you know, people like Hughes or Brooks or Rita Dove or Cornelius Eady today are all taking different kinds of music, different aspects of music, and writing about them, with them, through them, and sort of as music.
And it's not just music in a sort of European tradition where it's detached and on the page or in some sort of a very formalized performance. You describe here in a very powerful way, at least from my standpoint, how the partying, the way that the music is played, and you can go to the Harlem Renaissance and talk about how jazz was played and how literature was a piece in those experiences and take it right to hip-hop, where some of these hip-hop albums have songs,
mm-hmm.
they have tracks, but they also have these kind of playful flights of fancy as though there's a party going on.
Well, yeah, I mean, I love the skit tradition in hip-hop, sort of started by De La Soul in the late 80s.
Whack, man, whack.
I give that one props to
you. Why are y'all dissing it? I like it, man.
You know, people have taken it, I think, pretty far. You don't see them as much, I think, anymore. But I also sort of bemoan a little bit the lack of the concept album that you really saw then. And I think you see that kind of the album as an idea and almost as a community.
You miss Lauryn Hill.
I do. Miss, and her new name is Miss Lauryn Hill, so you've gotten it exactly right. Ms., actually.
The idea of the party, though, and you quote James Brown in here about the importance of dancing in this book, is a form of fighting back.
Yeah, I mean, I think the party is both an expression. You know, people sort of bemoan, early rap was just party music. But the party was an important vehicle for expression, as you said, and also of a kind of resistance, you know. And I think you see it in punk music. You see it in other aspects of music that I was really interested in exploring, too.
I have a personal question to ask you, though.
Please.
Do you think brilliant, sensitive writers like yourself writing in this time have it easy compared to your ancestors who aesthetically were fighting against such a headwind, produced genius in the midst of such adversity? Is that something to envy?
I don't know if any writer has it exactly easy. I mean you're trying to get it down, of course. I think that those ancestors are such an inspiration to me that I don't see them as separate. You know, I see them as me in some sense. And that's one of the things I'm arguing in the book, is that tradition is also us. You know, it's not something separate or something detached, and it's just waiting for you to take its hand and walk with it a ways.
Which do you prefer, lying or telling the truth in literature?
Tell the truth, but tell it slant. Is that what I'm supposed to say? I mean, I think that's probably right, and I think a lot of the artists here use lying as a way of, you know, fictionalizing their names, fictionalizing all sorts of things, but, you know, making a name for themselves by doing so.
We think his name is Kevin Young, award-winning poet and author of the Gray Album on the Blackness of Blackness. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
If you want to respond to that or anything else, you can do that at our website. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.